Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Practice Groups, was recorded on Wednesday, January 17, 2018.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleform Conference Call. This afternoon, we'll be discussing Judge Stephen Williams' newest book, The Reformer, How One Liberal Fought to Preempt the Russian Revolution. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us the Honorable Stephen F. Williams, Senior United States Court Judge at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and Professor Julia Fromholz, Director at the Rule of Law and Governance Program at Arizona State Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. After opening remarks from Professor Fromholz, we will go to opening remarks from Judge Williams and then question and answers. Thank you for speaking with us. Professor, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Laura, and it's a pleasure to have this opportunity to talk with you, Judge Williams, about your account of Vasily Maklakov in your new book, The Reformer. For the listeners, a brief background, Vasily Maklakov was a lawyer and member of the Duma during the years leading up to the October Revolution, and afterwards he was a member of the Russian emigre community in France. And he sought to establish a constitutional state and was a great proponent of the rule of law. Judge Williams, most listeners will know you as a highly esteemed D.C. Circuit Court judge, yet you're writing a book about Russian history. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I'd long been interested in Russia when I was growing up. When I was first politically conscious at all, Stalin was ruling Russia. His rule was a frequent topic of dinner table conversation in our household. And then when the Soviet Union collapsed, I was naturally very interested in what would happen next, as I guess we all were. And I thought it would be interesting to look at prior reform efforts and see how they worked out or didn't work out. And what I lit upon there was the Stolypin agrarian reforms, which were an effort to enable peasants to turn their interest in a commune into private land. And so I worked on that. And in the course of doing that, or in order to do that, I learned at least enough Russian to read it. And that came out in 2006, the 100th anniversary of the Stolypin reforms. And then I was thinking, as I finished that book, well, it was a little technical, a little wonky, and maybe it would be nice to look at the same period through the eyes of an actual human. Stolypin wasn't really the hero of that book; he was sort of an important player, but not a hero. So I looked around for someone whose eyes would be useful to look at the whole pre-revolutionary period, which I want to say on the pre-revolutionary period, it seems to me just dripping with missed opportunities, and so I wanted to look at those.
Thank you, and we are lucky indeed that you chose to casually learn Russian in order to do research and then produce these two books. And I think you've had some experience yourself with rule of law work in Russia. Could you tell us a bit about that and about what you learned?
Well, in a way, the sharpest lesson happened on the first day. The State Department organized it's called a rule of law trip to Russia, in which five U.S. judges, including me, went over to Moscow to have talks with various people, judges, professors, judges and professors almost entirely. And so we arrive in the airport in Moscow, somewhat groggy from the trip, and we're shunted off to some sort of waiting room. It's unclear what it normally functioned as. It was a bit dreary, but more than dreary, it was mysterious. because for quite a long time we weren't told why were we being put there. Then gradually the word came from our State Department handlers that the immigration authorities in Russia claimed there was something wrong with our visas. It was never clear what was wrong with the visas, but it did become clear that whatever was wrong could be cured by the State Department paying $100 per visa to have it remedied. And I was, as I say, groggy from the trip, and I wasn't as suspicious of the Russian bureaucracy as I would be today. But even then, it did seem very, very odd and likely to be part of basically a holdup run by local immigration officials to make a bit of money on the side. Anyway, the State Department paid up and the whole trip proceeded. And as I've thought about it ever since, it seemed to me, speak of missed opportunities, we missed a great opportunity to teach a small lesson to the Russians, namely that we don't like getting held up. And I think the trip should have been canceled. We should have been flown back immediately then and there. Or at least we should have said that that's what we'd do if this $100 fee was not eliminated.
It seems unfortunate indeed that the purposes of the trip were somewhat undermined by the actions of the State Department and the airport. And
of course, by the actions of the Russians, I mean, above all them.
Yes. Yes, of course. But if the State Department is bringing you there, helping you be there to press for rule of law reform, it's too bad not to start at the very beginning of the trip.
Yes.
So, and you, with that as background, and you mentioned that you, when you were researching and writing the Stolypin book, the land reform book highlighting Stolypin, you wanted to find someone for the subject of a biography. What was it about Maklakov that appealed to you?
Well, I was looking for someone who showed some indication of strong enthusiasm for the rule of law, because I thought that was a critical deficiency in Russia then as now. And so I sort of looked into a number of people. I briefly got interested in a philosopher who was probably, in fact, certainly more libertarian than Maklakov, but he seemed not to have any actual experience in the real world. So he never had an occasion to try to put his libertarian ideals into practice. Whereas it became clear that from, you know, very quick reading about Maklakov, that he very much had occasion to, in fact, I mean, his life was a series of occasions of trying to put his ideals into force or into practice, into enactment. So I plunged more deeply into him. And happily, I mean, I don't think I've missed somebody. But at least as my research progressed, I never encountered anyone who had the combination of his intelligence, his eloquence, his grasp of what the rule of law is really about, his effectiveness in trying to get it enacted, and I will say his charm. I find him a very charming person. In a way, if you write a biography of someone, you're spending a lot of time with them. I'm very happy to have spent a lot of time with Vasily Maklakov.
Well, his charm certainly comes through in your account of him. One of the themes that you draw out in the book about Maklakov's work is, and his focus is experience, and specifically that the reformers, of which he was a leading one, needed to have experience with negotiation and compromise. As the book shows, few of the reformers had this experience, which led to problems because they were too rigid in their negotiations, and the intelligentsia at the time was really opposed to compromise, and they're described in the book as rigid and utopian. What was it about Maklakov's background, perhaps in his family, perhaps as a trial lawyer, perhaps something else, that taught him the need for compromise?
Well, I think his childhood certainly had an interesting mix of an exposure to an interesting mix of viewpoints. First place, his father combined science. He was a professor of ophthalmology at Moscow University. Science with management. He was, in part, sort of indirectly, the manager of the Moscow Eye Clinic, which incidentally still exists and is still an eye clinic in the very same building it was in at the turn of the century. So there was already a mixture of slightly disparate focuses. His mother was a highly intelligent and well-read woman, and she was extremely religious, which was certainly not common in the intelligentsia in that era. So there was already a kind of in-family clash of viewpoints that must have taught him that you can have people can be very decent, fine people, and yet have fairly different viewpoints. I think, incidentally, that his mother's religiosity accounts for part of his father's viewpoint. His father was certainly a scientist, but unlike a lot of the intelligentsia of the period, he was not dismissive of religion at all. Another fairly early learning experience, relatively early, was getting to know Tolstoy. He became good friends of Tolstoy. And here was a man whom it would suggest that Maklakov was starry-eyed to say that he worshipped Tolstoy, but he certainly held him in the highest imaginable regard. And there's hardly any issue of political economy on which there was overlap between their viewpoints, so that he was accustomed from a fairly early stage of life to the idea that there can be very good people, very decent people, very smart people, who, it turns out, have different ideas, and they hold them in good faith, and it's a good idea to start with that as a working assumption.
I'm glad you mentioned Tolstoy, because there's a nice story in the book about some of the time he spent with Tolstoy going on walks with him. And could you just tell about that story? It reflects well on Maklakov.
I love that. I think it was after he had worked with Tolstoy on providing relief for the peasants in the 1891 famine, that Tolstoy took up the practice of asking Maklakov to join him on walks through Moscow. And during these walks, they would talk. One gets the impression that Tolstoy allowed Maklakov to do more than half the talking. And it puzzled Maklakov. Why would Tolstoy, who could presumably get anyone in Moscow to walk with him, choose a callow youth like himself to do this? And he found an answer later in a conversation with Tolstoy about why Tolstoy went around his estate, Yasnaya Polyana, on a bicycle and not by horse or possibly by car. And the answer from Tolstoy was that if he went by bicycle, he had to focus on that, and it prevented him from thinking in the sense of pondering problems, serious problems that he had to work out for himself. So it gave his mind a rest whereas on horseback or driving, he wouldn't have to focus so much. So Maklakov saw himself as providing the equivalent of a sort of mild mental diversion that bicycling around Yasnaya Polyana would have involved, which I thought, you know, is a very it's a very self-effacing viewpoint, but in a sense correct too, probably.
Yes, it's a charming story, and Maklakov later was admired for his oratorical skills. And he, one of the arenas in which he used those was in taking on rather unpopular cases as a lawyer. Do you see any cases that he took on as particularly formative for his later reform work?
That's interesting. Well, he certainly in arguments in the Duma. I mean, one thing that comes into mind in response to your question is religious freedom, and he did have some cases for what should we say, religious oddballs, doesn't seem fair, deviants, people whose religious views were certainly not strict orthodoxy, but they also had quite firm religious views, such as the Old Believers, who were a dissident sect from orthodoxy. And he got the experience of not only seeing what their lives and their thought process was like, but also the kind of frustrations that they encountered at the hands of the Orthodox majority and the beliefs who tended to back up the Orthodox clergy whenever possible. So I think that certainly... It's sort of a direct feed-in, really, between that set of clients who were brought to him mainly by Tolstoy and his later work in that field. The other thing that came with those trials was an exposure to, let's call it, the jury out in the countryside, the least sophisticated jury that was around, and he learned how to speak with them in a way that was convincing and direct, and he emerged with a high respect for them as jurors. He thought that they focused, they went to the right answer, they asked the right questions, or at least appeared to be thinking along the right lines. So sometimes he talked with them after a trial. So I think that helped him. It helped him couch oratory to particular audiences, which he had to do, of course, throughout life.
Interesting. And one of the audiences, of course, that he had to deal with, or maybe not a direct audience for his oratory, but an audience for the reform, was Nicholas II. And one of the other themes that you draw out of his work is good faith. And despite the reforms that Nicholas II implemented, he never seemed committed to the spirit of a limited monarchy. And Maklakov argued that the October Manifesto, which Nicholas II had issued, would work only if the government and others acted with good faith, meaning respect for the rule of law and willingness to seek compromise within the law. Do you think that the reformers could have in some way moved the government toward acting with better faith?
Well, this is, of course, one of the great ifs of the period. If there had been less intransigence on the reform side, might there have been less intransigence on the regime side? And I think, first place, to be honest, I think one can't possibly know. But I also think that the two things. One is, you know, there are all these studies that show that when two people sit down and chat with each other, if one is doing a sort of one kind of pattern with his or her, a sort of distinctive pattern with his or her legs or arms, the other tends to pick that up and mirror it. So I think, you know, we are social beings and we respond to a way of being treated. And if we're treated as people that it's valuable to talk with, we're likely to become, at least it's likely to move us towards becoming people that it is, in fact, valuable to talk with. So there's that. The other thing is that you're always talking of coalitions. The reformers were not monolithic. The regime was not monolithic. To the extent that the reformers sounded persistently like a monolith and really not that different from the revolutionaries, it was natural for the regime to think, you know, these people are utterly hopeless. But in fact, they represented broad coalitions, and the regime itself represented coalitions. And to the extent that either side made gestures attracting interest and sympathy from elements of the other's coalition, it's hard for me to see how that would not have at least helped make progress.
Okay, and one of the populations that was not seen as valuable to talk with and was represented at least in name by some of these different coalitions were the peasants. I think in the book, the statistic is that something like 90% of the Russian population at the time were peasants.
Yes.
And they, do you think that the environment of having a very large peasant population with very few formal rights made Russia in some ways hostile to the rule of law?
Well, it certainly meant that you had a vast segment of the population that had no experience of the rule of law at all. I want to make clear that Russia was not bereft of the rule of law in this period. But the rule of law was weak, and it was certainly incomplete. Of course, the rule of law is always incomplete. We never reach rule of law perfection, but it was certainly very weak in Russia, and scarcely applicable to the peasants at all. They had one great interest, which was in land, which was natural because that was the way they were able to acquire their food and clothing, and that was not. But they didn't own land. They had interests in land in a commune, which they worked out the cultivation of which they worked out with the other members of their commune. But nobody had what seems to me typical of the rule of law: the responsibility for deciding what you do with a particular item of property in the clearest case within the limits of the law. And it was simply within the limits of what the fellow commune members would agree to. And the courts to which they were subject were the least independent of the Russian courts. So they weren't getting exposed much to the rule of law on that side. And they were consistently subject to arbitrary treatment by government officials, namely the agents of the Ministry of Internal Affairs, who sort of managed them. It's really in some ways a staggeringly improbable way of running a country.
I think that there's an account in the book also about the peasants that and the rule of law system that applied to them that makes clear that in some ways the peasants stood to lose actually from rule of law reforms. And this had to do with their how they could deal with bad actors in their midst.
Yes, yes. No, that's true. I mean, as someone who believed that the burden of the state should not be applied to a person without going through decisions made by an independent actor, such as a judge who is obliged to hear both sides, that was a monstrous violation of the rule of law. But that was the system that prevailed and had obviously some advantages for the kind of the peasants who got along, didn't get too drunk, didn't do too wild things when they did get drunk. So in the course of one of the debates, essentially on the status of peasants, he argued very strongly, but got some pushback from peasants, on eliminating process by which peasants in an area could effectively demand that the Ministry of Internal Affairs ship some bad actor off to Siberia, and then the Ministry of Internal Affairs had veto power. That was not exercised in any kind of legal process. It was simply the exercise of their discretion. So, I mean, that's pretty extreme when you think about it. Deportation at the call of your neighbors and then approved by some non-law-abiding, not necessarily law-abiding, government official. But it was a handy way of getting bad actors out of the community. And, you know, we can imagine that sometimes bad actors would be hard to pursue through the criminal law. So there would be a loss for the relatively peaceful communitarian peasants. But on the other hand, the loss under the rule of law was substantial.
One of the things that I found particularly interesting about that aspect was that it showed how Maklakov faced complexities from every side in his efforts to reform the rule of law, not just from within his own party and from the monarchy, but from the peasants as well. Maklakov had this long career in the cadets, and maybe you could talk a little bit just about what he did in the years leading up to the October Revolution.
Well, I mean, that's a long story. That's the book.
hitting the highlights, I guess, just to give listeners a few highlights of what this man tried to do and accomplished.
Well, on the one hand, there were trials, and he had plenty of trials where he was defending typically people that we would call dissidents, but also, I mean, his most famous trial was the trial of Menachem Delis, who was not a dissident at all. He was just a plain, ordinary guy who had the misfortune to be Jewish at a point where a horrible murder of a child occurred, and some people had the bright idea of treating the murder of the child as a blood ritual committed by Jews, and poor old Bayless, as the nearest Jew on hand, became the victim. So Maklakov was his leading counsel, and incidentally, it's one of the interesting ironies of Maklakov's life that at that point, the Minister of Internal Affairs, who was essentially leading the charge on the prosecution, was his brother Nikolai Maklakov. So there was the experience as a trial lawyer, which was, I think, very useful. Then in the Duma, I think his big areas of reform are essentially independence of the judiciary, creating remedies for people whose rights are violated by government officials, protecting people from discrimination on the grounds of religion, which, as we know in America, is a tricky problem. But the issues he dealt with were relatively simple because compared to that, because the direct oppression of religions, above all, I guess, Judaism, were quite extreme, quite clear. But it also, of course, applied to such people as the Old Believers. The nationalities in Russia, the above all, we're talking of the Poles and the Finns, who, I mean, if one thinks of the Russians as not having many rights correctly, you have to think of the Poles and Finns as in some ways having fewer rights. The Finns actually had more in some ways because they had a separate constitution and separate laws which were more protective of individual rights than Russian law. But those were always subject to being overridden by the Russians. And the Poles were in a somewhat similar situation, and the results certainly for Polish occupants of Russia, and recall that Russia had been given the lion's share of Poland in the final partition of Poland in 1795, those Polish, I shouldn't say citizens, subjects of Russia, were ruled more directly by the bureaucracy in St. Petersburg than any other Russians. Let's see, I'm trying to think, am I overlooking some group that he was working? Oh, and the peasants. I didn't talk much about the peasants. Let me say that his work on that was doubly complicated because while he clearly was working towards elimination of the burdens of peasants being in an estate, I mean, as you know, some summoning of the Estates General in France set off the French Revolution and brought an end to the estate system. Estates still existed in Russia up to 1917, and he worked on trying to eliminate those burdens, getting some pushback from people like Kerensky. We can go into that. It's an interesting topic. The other great issue on the peasants was this whole issue of land ownership. And on that, his party, the Constitutional Democrats, took an extreme view, and Maklakov would say an extreme and erroneous view. So he couldn't support it, and he couldn't, at least he found himself, they found that it was awkward to attack it. So he didn't participate in that as much as I think he should have. I would like to have seen him do. But I think it's fair to say he covered the waterfront of major rule of law issues in pre-revolutionary Russia.
And there's an interesting moment in his experience in his life in which stands in contrast to that, to his devotion to the rule of law, and that was when he was involved in the killing of Rasputin.
How do you see
that?
Well, I mean, as a biographer, it produces a conflict because I think really an interesting story. On the other hand, I don't think it reflects good credit on Maklakov. What happens is that the leader of the conspiracy, Prince Yusupov, makes an appointment to see him and comes over to see him and says that he has this scheme for assassinating Rasputin. And it becomes clear that Yusupov's notion is that eliminating Rasputin will remedy what ails, or at least go a long way to remedying what ails Russia. This is, we're talking about late 1916. And it's true that Rasputin's influence was perhaps at its height there, and it took the form of being sort of the ringmaster for what came to be called ministerial leapfrog where ministries were constantly changing hands, with Rasputin at least understood generally to have quite a big hand in deciding who would go and who would come. So Maklakov thought this was nonsense. He thought that Rasputin was a symptom. It was not the cause. It was the weakness of the Tsar, the influence of the Tsarina, much more than Rasputin himself, and removing Rasputin would not solve it. But a series of conversations went on, and Maklakov got sort of sucked into the process of giving advice. You better not do this, but if you have hopes of accomplishing what you want to accomplish, you better not do that, and so forth. So he found himself involved, and I don't know if it's the very last interview with Yusupov. Yusupov spots a funny object which Maklakov was using as a paperweight and as potentially a means of defense, a kind of club with sort of heavy weights at either end so that you could clobber someone on the head. And Yusupov asks for it. Could he have it just in case it came in handy? Maklakov resisted, but in the end yielded. Now, at what point Maklakov became an accessory before the fact, I'm not sure, but he at least believes that he did become an accessory before the fact. And so I take his legal judgment on that. And he certainly was involved in it more than a law-abiding person should be. And in trying to explain it, I offer various theories. One is the being sucked in, getting to a point where he felt it would be shameful to completely abandon the conspirators. I'm not sure how far that can go. And then I'm reduced to saying that he had not fully taken in something that one of the people who were involved in sort of chastening him for his youthful escapades had said, which was that you must learn to rule yourself in case you may have to rule others. And I think it has to be treated as a case where he failed to rule himself properly.
That is a good admonition for today's world as well.
It is, isn't it?
Yes. One question that you may get when you talk about the rule of law is some people might say, for example, there was rule of law in this era in Russia. There were laws during Stalin's time. There were laws throughout the Soviet Union. How can you say that there was no, what is rule of law? How can we say that, are we just exporting Western values on this, or why can we say that there wasn't rule of law in Russia this time?
Right. No, I would not say there was not rule of law. I would say rule of law was distinctly weak. Starting with the reforms of Alexander II in 1864, judges, at least the main set of judges in Russia, had on paper what we would regard as good tenure protection. They could not be dismissed or reassigned against their will on paper. But the person who was Minister of Justice for a large chunk of the period where Maklakov is active, a guy named Shaglavatov, admitted in later testimony that it was possible for him to bend judges when he felt it was necessary to do so. Well, that's, of course, you know, he obviously was talking of cases where he did bend judges. how many other cases were there where a judge anticipating being bent, bent himself, I mean, did essentially, self-censoring. It's not censoring when it's a judge, but anticipates the response of the Ministry of Justice and accommodates them. So it was weak in that sense. There was a system of courts, the main one to which the peasants had access, which was run entirely by people without legal training, and also run by people, or deeply influenced by people, who were simply officials of, hear it again, the Ministry of Internal Affairs, which was not particularly, had no commitment to law, no legal training, no notion of what we think of as judicial norms. So those seem to be, and I mean, the result was you have an executive branch, which is it's constrained politically, but it's nowhere near as constrained as we like to think our executive branch should be. Oh, and as for being Western values, I've been thinking about that. I think in the development world, I mean, the world of people who are interested in development of undeveloped countries, there's this phrase, getting to Denmark, which is it's a capsule for the idea that a lot of people around the world who aren't living in a place like Denmark would like to live in a place like Denmark, where most of the time you're safe, where government isn't doing outrageous things, where there's not extreme corruption. And why people would not want to live in such a world is hard for me to imagine. So to call that Western values and to call boosting that as imposing Western values doesn't seem to me to make sense. Of course, imposing, I should add to that, the last thing I would favor was some idea of a U.S. Demand of the rule of law enforced by troops.
Well, I agree with you on all of that, not surprisingly. And we are coming to the close of our time, but I can't resist asking one last question. In the book, there's an account of Maklakov going to France at one point and lobbying against a loan that the French government is considering giving to Russia. And it turns out that he's too late, his lobbying comes too late. But I have to ask whether you think that his activities in France would have violated the language of the Logan Act, which is actually mentioned in your book.
I have to say that I think that if the Logan Act were on the books in Russia in 1906, it would be hard to say that Maklakov had not violated it. He spoke to very high French officials, Clemenceau, who was not then prime minister, but was, I forget his exact ministry, but he was extremely high in the French government and could have exerted influence on the French government if the whole exercise had not come too late. So he certainly was, Maklakov was certainly speaking directly and emphatically to a foreign government to thwart efforts by his own government that were being carried on with and through the foreign government, namely to raise a huge loan, which Maklakov and other liberals feared would just enable the regime to postpone reform. It looks to me like a violation of the Logan Act. Of course, we don't have any interpretations of the Logan Act because it's never been enforced. But and I should say that, as I did in the book, I think the real problem with what he was doing there was the political, the way it looked politically, to the extent that it came out, and I think it came out only in sketchy, not altogether credible terms, to be fighting your own government with foreigners, encouraging foreign governments to resist your government, does not look good. It violates some sort of natural norm that I think most countries have.
Well, that's an interesting and relevant note on which to end. And the book is while it is about Vasily Maklakov and a period in Russian history, there are so many accounts and lessons in it that remain quite relevant to our world today, and the continuing search for or effort to promote the rule of law around the world. Judge Williams, I just want to thank you very much for such an interesting discussion.
Oh, well, thank you for asking, I thought, interesting questions, and clearly having read the book in a way which saw the questions there.
Well, my pleasure. And if you have any last words, I turn it over to you or back to Laura.
No words except thank you and the Federalist Society.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.